Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. This show is available on iTunes, and like all of the podcasts here at WFYI, available on Spotify. Friends, we're going to do an extra long special show this week because Mike Perry, the director of on-air branding and promotions at WFYI, has retired this weekend, and first off, salute to Mike and the Marm. I hope you guys get plenty of quality time together. But besides all the work that Mike did here at WFYI, he is a vital cog in the history of film sociology. He's one of the most regular and irregular and usual suspect guests that we've had here in the history of the show. Back when Film Sociology was live Fridays at 5 o'clock, and he was a regular guest, but he was also Letterman's tenure at NBC. Mike Perry was my Tony Randall. If somebody dropped out, putzed out, or just couldn't make it for whatever reason, most of the time I could rely on him to come and fill in on short notice. So, Mike, thank you. I will never forget all of your contributions to the show, and I hope to have you on the show again when you're ready to pop your head out from the isolation and of life and getting away from this job and getting away from this building. So, the door is always open for Mike Perry. With that in mind, a great excuse to replay an epic chat that I had with Mike and Chris Appelfeld about the Hollywood Nights. We will start with a full show with an old intro and the discussion of the Hollywood Nights, and then we'll grab a pencil and see what's streaming around this middle part of the state. Thanks, Mike. And everyone, enjoy.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplexes and at the art house.
Warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
You'll also hear about new and old films on Blu-ray and on DVD. Plus, you'll hear all the latest Hollywood gossip.
I don't care!
Okay, maybe not the latter, but it is time for Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Shizzy!
No, that's Matthew Soucy.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yes.
Let's see how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Soucy.
Welcome, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or comment, you can email me at msocey@WFYI.org. Also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. The show is available as a podcast. It's also available on iTunes. And we have a blog, which is at WFYI.tumblr.com. Ladies and gentlemen, I don't get to say this very often with this program, but you are about to encounter a very special film sociology, one for the children and one for the family. So, and I have two guys I've been wanting to get as a trio for a while. But I'm going to start with, sir, if you could verbally sign in and your position here at WFYI.
Yes, thank you, Matt. My name is Chris Elberfeld, and I actually work in the television production department as a director of photography. But Matt and I, when we first met, I think one of the first conversations we had was a
this subject
quote for quote, yes,
of this film.
So of this film. Yes.
Now our other guest. Well, if you're a longtime listener, you know him. You know him so well. He has his own intro.
Lawrence of Arabia. He's an English guy. He came to fight the Turkish.
Okay, Clark, right there. That's what I'm talking about. Lawrence of Arabia doesn't have any lyrics to it. Doesn't have any words.
What do you mean doesn't have lyrics?
It's music.
To it?
It's music.
Hey, I've seen the movie four times.
And there were no words to it.
What are you
there are no words to that. Did you hear what I was saying earlier?
Somewhere I know that somebody, I think, wrote lyrics to this song.
And Mike Perry's in the house.
Well, someone had to write lyrics to that song. How else would he be singing it?
Exactly. So, Mike, Chris, thanks for hanging out. So, ladies and gentlemen, what brings this trio together besides odd taste in films and camaraderie? From 1980, a film called The Hollywood Nights. And that's what we're talking about today because, quite honestly, I didn't get a chance to see the big blockbusters opening this weekend. And, frankly, I don't want to. So I want to talk about this. We were able to finagle all of our schedules together as one. These are three separate zip codes happening at the same time, folks. So your pledge dollars at work. And what a better way to spend your pledge dollars than talking about this film.
WFYI.org/give.
Exactly. So, Chris, I know Chris and I and Mike and I talked about this film early on when we first got to know each other. And this is now we are men of a certain age, not the HBO series, but we are of a certain age. This is probably one of the top quoted films of our canon.
Or at least of our department.
Right.
Yeah. Yes.
We don't have a list, but there are certain ones you could quote along quite often.
Yes.
So
this is another timeless classic from that. From that decade, from that niche.
Yeah,
it's the era that gave us Porky's and name another one.
Caddyshack. Caddyshack.
Yeah. Last Times at Ridgemont High.
There have been, and it's funny because as I was setting this up, I had a dear friend on social media, hi Moneypenny, who was dying to find out what we were talking about, and she gave a couple good guesses, but we'll get to those in a little bit. But this was at the height of the R-rated slob comedy. Which I think starts in the mid-70s, but we'll get to that in a little bit. For me, The Hollywood Nights is the most underrated of the group. People know Porky's, people know Animal House, people know Caddyshack, but this was one, it was a smaller film, I'm gonna sound like Mel Kiper, under the radar, but this is one of those, when Tony Danza is your big name, because he was doing Taxi at the time.
Yeah, he had just started doing Taxi.
Right, and I heard I listened to the DVD commentary, that's right, I did this for you people. But yeah, Tony was filming Taxi by day and then coming and shooting this at night. But yeah, so I guess we'll start with, first off, it's set in Beverly Hills, 1965, and Tubby's Drive-In, which apparently, according to the snobs, this is your typical slob versus snob story, the drive-in is being closed and they're going to, pave paradise and put up an office building. Sorry, Joni Mitchell. And it's the kids' last night of camaraderie at Tubby's on Halloween night, which we'll get to in a little bit, especially Southern California Halloween nights. And so anyway, I guess, Chris, do you remember the first time you experienced this film?
I do, and I think it was on HBO, believe it or not.
Of course.
I was probably over at a buddy's house, because I don't think I had HBO as a kid, but a friend of mine had it, and saw a bunch of those movies from the late 70s and early 80s as they, I don't know how much time Hollywood Nights spent in the theaters, but
not as long as it did on cable.
Oh, yeah.
But I mean, I can remember just, thinking it was like you had explained, it was that slob versus snob, but it had a few big names and it had, great comedy, great timing, beautiful women. It had all the elements of that a teenage boy, was attracted to.
If you don't mind me asking, how old were you?
Let's see. I was probably, if it came out in 80, I may not have seen it till 82 or 80, may have been a couple of years after. So I was probably, maybe 13 or 14.
Okay. I was probably 11 or 12. I didn't see it in the theaters. That was ladies and gentlemen, especially you young folks out there, there was that period of once a movie
hit the theaters, and then it was gone. Mm-hmm. And so then that's why the concept of home video and then cable became such a revelation of, oh, crud, we missed it in the theaters, but now you have a second and a third chance. Because if I remember right, I believe it was film, then video, then cable. I think that's how the old system used to work. So,
but it took a while.
It did take a while. You had to wait like 6 months for a video to come out. Yeah, so and then there was that period where you knew a film was bad when it was able to come out on video in like 2 months.
That's right,
1 month.
You don't even remember it in the theater.
Right, quick turnaround. So, yeah. Mike, how about you?
I was of drinking age when the movie came out.
Lucky.
I remember fondly, just like Chris, you know, watched it on HBO endlessly with my friends. It was like if Porky's and American Graffiti had a baby, it would be the Hollywood Nights.
Yeah, there is that look to it. I was, like I said, I was about 11 or 12. And, yeah, listening to the director commentary by writer-director Floyd Mutrix, he referred to it as Animal House for the car kids. Mm-hmm. I, of course, kept thinking of it as an R-rated American Graffiti. Because it does have similar images, themes, characters.
True, yeah. The drag racing and all that kind of things, the cars.
Yeah.
But it was a little bit not quite as family friendly, you know.
Oh, heavens no. Oh, no. So, watching it again, I watched it twice in one day. I can't remember the last time I did that. Mm. But going through the slob versus snob thing, I was funny. I've maybe it's a different generational thing, but I remember showing my daughter, who's now 14. I remember showing her the film version of MASH, and her saying how mean spirited it was. If you think about the treatment of Hot Lip and Frank, now for me, of course, it was these guys thumbing their nose at any form of authority. It just so happens with these two individuals. So anyway, I found that interesting. But I was going through thinking about how the pranks are pulled in this. And it does have an innocent feel to it. I mean, it's supposed to be Halloween of 1965. And there's little hints of things to come. Like the character of Jimmy, one of the Hollywood Knights who's got to go to Vietnam. And the guys are treating it like it's World War II or Korea. The fact that there aren't that many pledges into the Knights. There's little hints of music by the Birds and the Mamas
and
the Papas.
Yep, 8-track tape.
So
yep.
there's that kind of, and of course, I think Floyd says in the commentary that really the 60s began in 1965, which explains if you think about the music in this. There's a lot of 50s tunes.
Great
in
music,
this.
Yeah.
So and good luck getting this soundtrack. I mean, I think this is why it took so long for it to come out on video. It had the WKRP Miami Vice disease when it comes to song rights. Anyway, the other thing is we have the Hollywood Knights, we have Tony and Michelle, and we have Jimmy. So there's like three and the pledges. So
and the pledges.
Mean,
so you got like four different
subplots
going on.
There's several plots going
on.
Yeah,
right.
There's a lot of stuff going on.
It's like an Altman film without the overlapping. So, yeah, on this night, we have a kid who's about ready to go overseas, to go to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. We have a couple that are in, you know, late teen angst, even though they're in their 20s. All right, Danza was like 26. Michelle was not, thank God. Tony Danza and a young Michelle Pfeiffer. Mm-hmm. Salute.
Yeah.
Then we have the pledges. We have four guys that are trying to get into the car, the car gang. So, Mike, tell them how they get into the initiation is.
The initiation was pretty simple. They took the pledges and took away their clothes, gave them spare tires, and told them they had to go to a record store in Watts in 1965.
With a white DJ.
And get him to play a request song that then the Knights had to hear while it's still at Tubby's. They had to do it before 2 a.m.
Correct. So, yeah, naked with tires.
Yeah, four tires, and that's it. No clothes. And, dropped off Four white guys in the middle of Watts.
Or as Neubaum Turk says, you're lucky. Last year we put the pledges in a really bad neighborhood. but there is that thing of, and I think Floyd says in the coverage, he's like, doing it in 65 would be a little different than, say, 67, yes. 68. Mm-hmm. That would. So it just kind of, you know, it's a slob comedy, folks. It's an R-rated grown-up. You know, some of us were too young to see it probably when it came out. Whatever. we're fine. But it does kind of ride that rail of really crossing, for me, crossing the line. Yeah. But then again, I think we had probably thicker skin back in 1980, I think.
Yeah. It's one of those movies that if you were new to it and you grew up in, say, you know, after the turn of the century, you're going to find a lot of stuff in this movie offensive.
Yeah.
But those of us of a certain age and a certain tolerance for such things, you know, it's still to this day one of my favorite movies.
Yeah, I think Mrs. Soucy likes to use the term made by boys for boys.
Yes,
that's right.
And if you see what the Knights do, especially when Neubaum's taking photographs poolside and hanging out of trees. Yeah. And
Let's face it, these guys weren't your just typical. I mean, they were pretty creative, clever pranksters. I mean, these weren't just ham and eggers. You know?
Did you learn a lot of pranks from this? Because there's a couple things I discovered. Again, we're going to word this carefully. I did not know about the one-armed violinist.
Yes.
Until this film. This film also introduced me to the concept of filling a bag with something and setting it on fire.
Spiking the punch.
Well, I knew spiking the punch was liquor. Didn't know it was
not
that.
Liquor.
Yeah, thank you. Not liquor. So I hope you're rushing to Amazon now.
Yeah.
So those pranks, and of course recording the twins as they're talking in the bathroom, little things like that. There is a moment in the film involving Neubaum Turk, played by Robert Wool, in his film debut, and at the time was a writer for Rodney Dangerfield, which explains a lot.
Oh, yeah, it does.
Because he tried getting a lot of his jokes in the film, and only a handful did. I can tell the punchline of one, his pants fit like a glove.
Yes.
So apparently, you know, he tried out as many jokes as he could, but there is a moment at a pep rally. Okay, so I mentioned this is Halloween night, 1965. There is a pep rally and a dance slash talent show.
At the high school.
Yes. Who holds a pep rally at night?
Right?
Did you ever have one at night?
With a live band and
cheerleaders that forget certain clothing items.
True. Yes.
Yeah. And anyway, but I thought, really? I thought that was something you did in the daytime.
During school. Yeah.
Am I right?
You're right.
Did you?
Oh, here, yeah.
Okay.
Here in Indiana, yes.
But
you're right.
That wouldn't have fit the script, though. Then no. They couldn't.
Well,
have
I know that,
tied that
but
all
I thought that was slightly weird of doing it at night, and then the same night you have a talent show and or a dance.
Well,
yes. That's a lot of activity.
I always thought that this movie was kind of built like a Quentin Tarantino movie, where it kind of jumps.
Oh yeah.
Forward and backwards, and from scene to scene, it's nothing but a series of little segues.
Right.
Little sketches that. And then you move on to the next scene. You got more pranks, but like there's that one scene you mentioned with him recording in the bathroom. Well, he was just up a tree.
It's funny you mentioned that because as I was really studying this, and by the way, really studying it, there is a secondary or thirdary character, the blonde kid who's the skateboard sidewalk surfer, as he is called.
Yes.
Kind of tomboy, not tomboy, but kind of long haired, but smokes and skateboards. But he's at Tubby's in one scene, and then he's in the pep rally for the very next scene when a cheerleader forgets an item of clothing.
Right.
But, okay, so what Neubaum does in the pep rally, I will just say he performs along to the song Volare.
Yes.
And I was 11 when I saw this, and it was fall off the chair funny.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I fell out of my chair laughing so hard. And I specifically remember that. There's only a couple of moments in my younger days where I fell out of a chair or a couch laughing, and that was one of them.
Yeah. And that was like, Neubaum Turk is my hero. who have you ever known that would pull something like that?
Did you do that for a while when you knew something was rumbling and you just sang to yourself, Volare.
Okay, now each of us here has daughters, but we don't have sons, right?
Yes.
No, I do.
I have two daughters.
I have one daughter. You know what it is? It's poetic justice for our youth.
Yeah. It's a punishment for being bad boys.
Yep.
Would you have wanted to name a son Newbomb?
Heck no. No. No, but I wouldn't want to name her Susie Q or Fran either.
Yeah. Fran Drescher, that's right. I mean,
we'll get to her. We'll get to her in a sec. But yeah, and I didn't think, and that, I mean, the song was ruined. Well, not really ruined. It was, I think, immortalized. And that is also a rare song because it has been immortalized twice. The second time, which actually my daughter did see, when Kevin Kline sings it in A Fish Called Wanda,
mm-hmm.
when he's going through his myriad of Italian vocabulary to impress Jamie Lee Curtis. Thanks, Kev.
Yes.
Enjoy the Oscar. But yeah, that was a moment. I think that's funnier than, oh, how should I put it? The yanking scene in Porky's. I know that's their kind of signature moment.
Right. Yeah. Although not the funniest scene in Porky's. We can talk about that.
Right,
later.
Correct. I think most of the stuff in Animal House is a great film. I think for me, Volare was the 550-foot home run out of the ballpark.
Yeah.
It just caught me at the right time. So yeah, we've mentioned earlier. So we mentioned we have some new cast members. So you had Tony Danza was the big name, young Michelle Pfeiffer, who had just done a TV series of Animal House mm-hmm. called Delta House. Robert Wool in his debut, and Fran Drescher, who as Floyd said, I guess was Miss New York. When she was 18, came to Hollywood, starred in the film he did before this. Do you remember American Hot Wax?
Yes.
Yes.
That's, yeah, which explains a lot with Floyd. The story of Alan Freed with Tim McIntyre. Mm-hmm. I think also Jay Leno's film debut in that. And she is in that with the squeeze scene, which we can't really talk about. Then she had a one scene wonder where she grabbed John Travolta's tush in Saturday Night Fever, and then she got this film. Not a bad way to start out.
No.
Building up to Bobby Fleckman and then The Nanny. So, yeah. we could do a myriad of Fran Drescher. We're not. So, but you kind of get.
But when we talk about UHF, we'll get around to her.
Right. So, but yeah, so you have these four different stories, and Mutrick said he probably thought he maybe had too many characters, and as I was watching it, the other knights. I mean, you have Jimmy, and then you have Tony Danza's character, I believe, was Duke, which
Mr.
had
Wheatley.
Yeah, you had the emotional scenes of those the older guys.
Yeah, the older guys didn't take part in any of the hijinks of the movie.
No, and I forgot there is one line exchange between Robert Wool and Tony Danza on the streets, and that's it. So yeah, that's a weird. But like the secondary guys that are in the car, the one who's trying to imitate James Dean,
right?
You know, really underdeveloped.
Yeah, it looks like all of Danza's scenes were shot in a day.
Probably were, but yeah. I mean,
for getting star billing, he's in like four scenes in the movie.
And that's never stopped a film before either. And the fact that they, I guess, Tubby's and the garage were literally next to each other. Yeah. So when one was up, the other was lit, the other one was, you know, lights were off, and they were able to bang through that.
I liked during the scene of where they gave the car to Jimmy Shine at the end, they even, you know, he kind of broke character and called Tony Danza by his real name. Remember, he said, Yellow, that's Tony Danza yellow. I mean, it was right. Like, you had to figure that wasn't in the script.
It's not just, you know what? Breaking character is not just for Mark Hamill anymore.
Yeah.
So, and also the fact that, you know, there were emotional moments in a slob film long before Judd Apatow.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I kept thinking back of, well, like Peter Riegert and Karen Allen in Animal House. That's probably your emotional core.
Yeah. There's your love.
That's your love story, yeah. And they really played it. They really played it well. And I think Tony and Michelle are fine in the quick scenes that they have together.
Sure, yeah. But it did seem secondary to the hijinks and the pranks.
Yeah, we wanted more pranks and
more pranks,
or at least give us more Michelle Pfeiffer on roller skates.
That's
true. I'm sorry. Was that me? Yeah. thanks for that. Okay, so there's also, so I think we've talked about so we have the slob characters, we have the lovers, we have the kids that are doing the initiation.
How about the victims?
Well, we'll get to that. Okay. We have the victims who are flawed, for one thing. It would be, you know, compared to, say, Dean Wormer, who really didn't have any, if they caught Dean Wormer with his pants down, but that happens with Mrs. Friedman and her lover, which apparently...
Movie developing into this.
So, which I think as a kid even added to it even more. Here's these stuffy authority figures who are pointing the finger at everybody, but they're also having an affair.
Yes.
That really helped.
Lee French in a great role. Those of you who are of a certain age will remember her from the Smothers Brothers comedy album.
Yes.
Where she usually played a hippie. So this is really, you know, a 180 for her.
Right.
That's Mrs. Friedman?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
because
I believe, yeah, how's
she
it going?
She played that part perfect.
Yeah.
I mean, she knocked that part out of the park, I thought. I mean,
yeah,
it
was the kind of, North Side suburb housewife we would expect.
Right. Uptight, you know.
Right. And then, of course, you know, there's also a grab at the beginning of the film. I was like, whoa.
Yeah.
Then we have, and I know Mr. Perry has a little connection to this, the police.
Yes.
So Bimbo and Clark.
Officer
By the
Bimbo,
way,
yes.
It is not spelled B-I-M-B-O. I looked it up. It's a Cajun spelling.
Yes.
E-A-U-X.
Now, how do you pronounce his real name, the actor?
Well, Gaylord Sartain.
Thank you.
Gaylord Sartain.
I was trying to read it, and I don't even know how to pronounce
Gaylord
it.
Gaylord Sartain, of course, best known as that one of those guys from Hee Haw.
Right.
And but Mr. Perry has a story. Story time,
I
folks.
Do. Gaylord Sartain was starred in a movie that I was an extra in
called
Ernest Goes to Jail.
I've heard of it.
It's when I was living down in Tennessee. I was working at a TV station there, and they came and asked if we'd be interested in playing a news crew for this one scene that was actually shot at my bank.
Nice.
So, it was an all-nighter on the scene, and I played a photographer for a news crew. And I'm in all of 10 frames of this movie.
I was going to say, how long did it
My 10 frames of fame. But,
see, that's something less like me in Die Hard 2. Thank God for the pause button. You're like, tink, tink, tink.
There I am, see?
Yep.
That's me.
But if you look real close, you can see me with my camera on my shoulder looking up as Ernest supposedly gets blown through the roof of the bank.
And you're getting a shot of it. Yeah.
Yep.
That one film where Ernest gets blown up.
Yep.
Now, were you able to approach him?
Yes. Yes. We actually spoke briefly in the food service line.
And you told him your butt was grass and he was a lawnmower.
Nice. If I smell any rubber, Benedict Canyon.
No, I did mention to him that I remembered him from Hollywood Nights.
Did he appreciate it?
Because everyone remembers him from Hee Haw. So,
everybody
says
that.
He smiled. I at least got a smile out of
him. Yes.
Now, I don't know. There was I was going to say, he had his own. Did he steal the show? New Bomb Turk was incredible. You know, you had all these angles coming at you. Like, these guys, this is a action-packed, funny movie.
In the commentary, Floyd talks about that they would film, like, 10-minute takes of Bimbo and Clark in the car. They would just go. He apparently gave Gaylord, like, very little direction, if anything. As he said, he knew where the jokes were. So there's a scene where Bimbo is stuck in the bathroom while the knights have flooded the toilet, stuffed it down full of toilet paper.
Locked them in there, yeah.
Folks, don't do this at home. And you know what? Don't do this in public either. Just don't do it. So anyway, they stuff it down, and there's the moment where Bimbo has to, you know, use the facilities. Oh, by the way, the tearing of the magazine and ruffling it up, his idea.
Nice.
So you just let the camera roll. He'll come up with something. So. And then, of course, the door is locked, and there's trash spewed in the front. And then, things start to – but that was all him. It was just like, kind of put the camera there. He'll make it funny.
He's brilliant. Yeah,
yeah.
I remember he even, like, murmured to himself, like, Clark. You know, he's, like, thinking about, like, all the stuff his partner was saying that made him mad.
But the scenes in the car – now, you heard one where, they would go for 10 minutes. See, I not jokingly said, I wish Criterion would put out a 2-disc set of the Hollywood Nights with commentary and essays and all that. I'd love to see the extended scenes. I'd love to see Clark and Bimbo in the car for 10 minutes going off.
The chemistry was good. I mean, there was two perfect casts for those two parts.
Yep.
And how would you like to hear the commentary today? Get Tony Danza in there. Get Robert Wool in there and Fran Drescher.
There's got to be a film festival in L.A. that just wants to have another screening of this. Please, somebody do this and then invite us.
Please.
Because most of them are still around, too.
Oh, yeah.
Why not? But, and of course, we played with Mike's cut earlier of the arguments over Lawrence of Arabia, which is now forever burned in my head.
Does it actually have lyrics or not?
And then, you know, the argument over Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass. Plus, Gaylord says something, I'm going to word it again. We're wording this carefully. As children, and young adults, we have certain words that we use when we call shenanigans on somebody, usually starting with a bull.
Right.
Thanks to him, we added horse.
Right.
We
and
added
it was
horse.
Perfect. Yeah.
Yeah, because, well, boy, I hadn't thought of that. Yeah. Thanks. Thanks, Hollywood Nights.
It sounds good the way it rolls off your tongue like
it,
that.
It does. And there's a great scene where the PTA is having their meeting and the guys are yelling at each other in the kitchen finally,
yes.
Where there's just a pause in the conversation. You hear, horse. That was a beep, folks.
It was, I mean, it's like you know, you open up a can of worms. We start talking about this film, and all the millions of funny little parts start coming back to you.
And most of them we can't really talk about.
No,
yeah,
we
that's
can't.
True. That's
but
true.
Those who've seen it,
yes,
yeah,
you
you're
know,
welcome.
You'll get it.
You know
yeah.
exactly what it is. So yeah, I was going back. I also I'm going through my notes. Yes, right here, folks. Notes like Jim Rome. Yeah, that was the other. So there's we have a talent contest, and there's guys in their 30s playing 50s rock and roll, mm-hmm. and the kids are really dig. I mean, it was again. This was before the there wasn't really a representation of the generation gap
right.
that was really going to hit with the mid 60s. But I know I think it was the guy who from Jay and the Americans was a part of that band and put that together. Yeah, there's also we mentioned earlier the one-armed violinist.
Mm-hmm.
So the other thing I just discovered this last month, and so I thank my DVR for this, but, I'm going to say, Chris, if I made an intro for you, it would probably be the censored words of Mr. Katzenberg.
Yeah.
But there's another staple in the slob comedies is the old person. There's usually like one old person that's either on the receiving end or witnesses something, and
yeah,
there is an old European gentleman who points out things.
Points out the obvious.
Loudly.
Yes,
yes loudly. And of course, that's the
nothing gets by him the whole
no,
movie.
Not quite. Not at all. Not the punch, not the violinist, nothing. And but what's funny is with these films, yeah, we talked about there's like two dozen characters in this film, but they're burned into our memory
yes.
because the film is that memorable. And if you saw them in anything else after this, you're like, hey, it's so-and-so. I remember this happened with Animal House and Caddyshack mm-hmm. and Porky's. You're like, oh, hey, it's so-and-so. So I couldn't think of seeing this guy in anything else until he was the subplot in one of the most famous episodes of Barney Miller. Care to think which one of the most famous episodes of Barney Miller?
No.
Don't know.
The one involving the hash brownies.
Oh.
Yeah.
The guys, of course, that an episode where I believe it's Wojo's girlfriend, he, of course, dates women from the other side of the tracks, brings a plate of brownies and doesn't tell them that it's filled with hash, and everybody in the precinct, including Fish, digs in. So
only in the 70s.
Right. But the secondary plot is there are two gentlemen, older gentlemen, who are arrested. One was a theater actor that's played by this guy, and then a theater critic. They're both Polish, and they got into a fight in the streets over a bad review. And I'm like, hey, it's the guy who yells
from Hollywood Nights.
Yeah, who yells those things we can't say. So little things like that. So thank
sure.
you, IMDb and DVR, for that. Gosh, I'm going through all this.
Oh yeah, I'm going through the cast list now, so you can find his name.
I think I have it written down over here. Yes, I'm going through my things as well. Yeah, I'll talk about that a little bit. We have Walter Janowitz,
yeah.
as Martin Katzenberg, who was in Barney. Now, for you TV buffs, that's you, Mike. I forget, he was Oscar Schmittner in Hogan's Heroes.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
then it was also he also played an Amish guy in The Frisco Kid and played a rabbi in the Neil Diamond version of The Jazz Singer.
Wow.
Among others. I know. This is your okay. One other thing I know we haven't gotten to just yet, and we were talking about the tone and the spirit and the pranks. One thing that really kind of resonated, and it took me a long time to figure this out, is, you know, of course, the Knights' pranks toward authority are very, you know, direct and to the point. But there's also a character, and this is another stock character in the slob comedies, the nerd slash outcast the honor student Dudley, played by Stuart Penkin.
That's right.
Who, by the way, was 33 years old when he did this film.
Playing a high school student.
He is right up there. He now ties with Stocker Channing in Grease.
I thought you were going to say Ralph Macchio in Karate Kid.
No. I had to correct myself on these very airwaves. I thought she was 36 when she played Rizzo. No, my bad. Only 33.
33.
But yeah. Oh, by the way, Tony Danza was 26. Robert Wool was 26. Gaylord was 30, right, but that's okay. Fran was 20. Michelle was 22. And Gary Graham, who played Jimmy, was 27. I'm sorry, 27. So,
but about 10 years older than their part was supposed to be.
Basically. Stuart Penkin, classically trained actor, had already done the San Pedro Beach Bums TV series before this. And
one season?
One season.
I remember that when it came on as a kid, and I don't think it made it to the end of the season.
It didn't.
No, it did not. And then I later saw him. I was like, hey, it's Dudley, when he did Not Necessarily the News on HBO. Mm-hmm. But the treatment of Dudley. So Dudley has this overbearing mother, and he's just kind of a dumpy guy and trying to get his awards.
Very sheltered.
He is abducted not once, but twice by the Knights for Newbaum's nefarious plans. But they treat him gentle.
Yeah.
And then
it's not mean-spirited at all.
No, and the first one, you're not quite sure. The second one, of course, he got to see ladies' body parts. Mm-hmm. And as they were blindfolding him, they gave him a beer.
They did, yes.
So between that and then there's a really nice part, the second half, near the end of the film, right, where he helps delay the police from chasing after some of the guys, and then he becomes part of the gang.
Yeah, and eventually gets a jacket at the very
That's
end.
Right. That's right. He's holding Jimmy. I had never seen that before in a film, if I remember right, where an outsider, somebody that far outside the realm, is brought in. Right. Can you guys think of another? I mean, I can't really.
You could argue, Flounder and Animal House, but
to a certain degree, but
Animal House was all,
he's kind of pledging that, or I guess, that's not even that, but I immediately think of Mackenzie Phillips in American Graffiti, mm-hmm, but that's different, and that's more emotional, not really romantic, although she wants it to be. That really resonated with me, and it took me a long time to figure out why.
You'd think with all the action going on in this film and all the different scenes and different people, and that there'd be even room for one more guy like that.
Right.
It's like, I could just remember thinking these guys did so much stuff in one night. It was like, it was like a weekend's worth of pranks in about 6 hours.
No, you felt bad. You're like, God, I'm really behind. We of course never TP'd anybody I think also the potato and the tailpipe. There was long before, 4 years before the banana and the tailpipe in Beverly Hills Cop.
Right.
Again, folks, please don't do this. It's just what we read.
Well, I'm going through the cast list now, and even now there are faces popping up that, were they in that movie, really?
I'll tell you one that's funny is one of the guys who was in The Initiation, I saw as a comic later on HBO, Mike Bender. And Mike Bender did, he's done a little bit of acting, but he's now directing.
And writing. He did The Contender. He did...
Wait, are you sure? I thought that was Rod Lurie, because I know he directed The Upside of Anger.
Right.
With Joan Allen and Kevin Costner. Black or White with Kevin Costner and Octavia Spencer.
Did he have a part in The Contender?
He might have had a part in The Contender. We'll have to check on that. Yeah. And then he also directed, that's going to bother me. Rain Over Me.
Yeah.
With Adam Sandler and Don Cheadle. So
Joyce Heiser. Remember Joyce Heiser?
Uh-huh.
She was one of the Weintraub sisters.
Yes. And the other one was the daughter of Eli Wallach and Ann Jackson.
Wow.
Wow, man.
Cool. And Cindy Williams' sister is one of the blondes. There's also, again, we talk about underwritten characters, but they have an impression. There's a blonde, right out of central casting, tall, blonde, skinny surfer guy named Tarzan with two blonde beauties on each arm.
Jane and Cheetah.
Thank you.
Jane and Cheetah.
Again, don't name your kids that. But there is, and there's also that moment of car culture versus surf culture. It's only a couple minutes. And then they go away. But, they do tap into – because, in the 50s, especially – American Graffiti is set in 1962. Mm-hmm. And that – and, of course, it's away from the beach, if I remember right. I think it's Central California. But, car culture and surf culture were different. And they dug each other, but I think they were kind of rooted one way or another, almost like Beatles and Stones.
Yes, he was in the contender. Mike Binder was.
Okay,
in
all right. So you were good there.
Yeah.
Also found out the cinematographer was a guy named William Fraker, who, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 nominations for cinematography.
Nice.
Before working on The Hollywood Nights, in 1 year, did the cinematography for Rosemary's Baby and Bullet, Exorcist II, The Heretic, Sharky's Machine. Loved Burt Reynolds in that film. Later did Honeymoon in Vegas, but he got nominated for doing cinematography for Looking for Mr. Goodbar, Heaven Can Wait, 1941, and War Games. So not bad for just a little $3 million picture. Yeah. And yeah, there's little things. You were saying earlier, Chris, there's a, of course, you have to have the drag racing scenes, which do nothing to move the movie along. Just, I think the fact that they had the two Chinese guys and one of them was a famous car painter, and the fact that they didn't get permits, of course.
Right. Of course.
Directors, don't do that. but there's two drag races. One, and I think they're both set to What I Say by Ray Charles, but one that the Chinese guys win, and of course in the second one, USA wins. So
that's right.
There
is that. Right. And everybody cheers. That's right.
Fraker also did Close Encounters and Cuckoo's Nest.
Wow.
That's not bad.
Two blockbusters, huh?
Exactly. So, yeah. So, anyway, it's just fascinating with all of this going on. There's so many scenes and moments. And even, like I said, even if they're underwritten, I think of that there's two knights that are in the car and they're worried about the future of the gang and what they're going to do. And there was already a couple of gang films of different styles before this. You had The Warriors, of course, Walter Hill's film that looked like futuristic. It felt like futuristic New York, even though it was late 70s New York. And The Wanderers.
Yes.
And The Wanderers, you've seen that?
I've seen that many times.
You haven't seen The Wanderers?
The Wanderers.
Really?
It's Bronx.
Ooh.
Gangs of the... Of
Ken
the,
Wall.
Yep.
Karen Allen. The guy who played
the
meat
guy played
in
Perry.
Porky's.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. You got to find that. I should let you borrow.
I saw The Wanderers also on HBO.
Oh, yeah. That thing was on constantly.
Yeah.
And that was another film that mixed the end of the 50s with the beginning of the 60s because you had the scenes with the Baldies and the Ducky Boys, which were terrifying.
Yes.
And so you have this gang that's, again, they look like they're in their mid-20s playing high schoolers. I guess that's a thing. You know, if you're in your mid-30s, you can be in college. Look at Tim Matheson and Up the Creek.
Yeah.
but there is moments of when their world, you know, the outside world is starting to peek in. Like Karen Allen's character, of course, is becoming sort of an independent female. She reads D.H. Lawrence of Arabia. Different Lawrence. But there's also a scene at the end where Ken Wall's character follows her and she goes into a coffee shop and there's some skinny guy with big hair and a guitar.
Robert Zimmerman?
Right, singing The Times They Are A-Changin'.
Yes.
And then there's two gang members that, well, one comes from an abusive household and they leave and they're going to San Francisco. And it was funny because you're watching this and you're like, yeah, it could be an easy punchline of, oh, two guys are moving into Frisco together.
Right.
But you're not sure and you're not 100%. Maybe, maybe not. But it didn't matter because it's two really nice performances and a pretty decent storyline with those guys.
Oh, yeah.
And there are moments of that. We said before in this film with the references to Vietnam, with the music by the Byrds and music by the Mamas and the Papas, really really impressed with just bringing it up.
Yeah.
So,
You
know what? Let's take a short break and then we'll gather our notes and we'll continue talking about The Hollywood Nights because we can. You're listening to a very special Film Sociology here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. Welcome back to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD To The Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msoci@wfyi.org. Also on Facebook, also on Twitter at Matthew Soci. Hanging out with Mike Perry and Chris Elberfeld, talking about the Hollywood Nights because we can. We can make a whole show devoted to this.
And yes, no one else will.
That's right. So if not us, then who?
Who will? I mean, honestly, that I remember the first time we started talking about it. My, you know, it was like, hey, here's somebody who knows this movie. You don't run into people every day that know this movie.
And by the way, hard to quote that movie at work. At least our work.
That's right. Yeah, we had to be very clever. Yeah.
If you worked at Smitty's Garage, maybe, and maybe Tubby's, but we don't. We're here. Yeah, we learn to be clever and know when not to say stuff.
We would, or we would do like half of it. So we would.
Right.
So
we the good
you,
half.
You'd suggest, you know, what it is, but not finish.
It's
all
like when I would do Abdul with radio with Abdul, and we start quoting Python or Richard Pryor until we can't.
Right. Yeah. There is a line.
There is a line there. So, okay, there was something we talked about in the first two-thirds of the show. We're in the last third. There's sort of a correction, and now I have to go watch it again to see what is actually said. Mike, you have an update. Yeah, breaking news on a 35-year-old film line
right.
update.
Okay, we were talking about the scene where they're giving Jimmy the
beautiful
new car, the beautiful yellow car, mm-hmm. Hot Rod. And I'll read from IMDb the trivia section for Hollywood Nights. It says, when the crew is gathered in Smitty's speed stop around the Ford, Duke, Tony Danza, asks, is this?
Blank yellow.
Yellow.
Urine
right.
Yellow?
There you go.
Urine,
yeah,
there
that's
you go.
Good.
Urine
that's
yellow.
Good. We can say that in a
Now, everyone thinks the answer that comes back is, it's Tony Danza yellow. But it's not really.
Okay.
It's Tony Nancy yellow. Because Tony Nancy, a Southern California car customizer and drag racer known for his yellow cars, was involved with the making of the film.
Right.
So, but if you go back to quotes, the quotes in IMDb still say Tony Danza yellow.
So it could be.
It could be.
Or Hold Me Closer, Tony Danza.
Yeah.
But yes, we're going to get the movie back out. We're going to settle this once and for all.
You know what, Criterion, there's 5 minutes on your disc for this line alone, I think.
Yeah. I mean, we were talking earlier about how many times we've seen it. And, you know, I've probably seen this movie over 50 times, maybe
easily.
75.
And this includes HBO.
And this includes HBO. And I've still to this day, until Mike just said that, thought it was Tony Danza.
See,
yellow.
This is the beauty of a piece of art. It changes. You change over time, even though the film does not.
Yes.
See that? Take that, George Lucas.
Yeah.
Don't mess with it.
Put that in your pipe and smoke it.
Or the tailpipe. And
don't
anyway.
Know. I think the bigger explosions are kind of cool.
And new bomb shot first.
Yes.
Bomb well, shot first. There is a scene with him and Fran. Another scene with they apparently.
Well,
Moving on, but apparently that also went on for 10 minutes because you had Robert Wool and Fran Drescher, two vocal titans that could knock people over verbally. And they kind of there is a scene where they're kind of overlapping and he finally exclaims he's glad he did what he did.
Right.
So there. So anyway.
He achieved nirvana. How about that?
Right. Let's move on fast. I probably see it just as many times because of cable. Now, it's one thing if we rented it 50. You might as well just buy the damn thing when it's all said and done.
I think too, one of my friends had recorded it off of HBO. So they had the blank cassette. You know,
VHS
cassette that we probably watched till it wore out.
So there are certain – and, of course, there are certain scenes where the tape is a little more worn than others.
Yes.
Pause.
Yeah.
Like the scene we were just talking
in
about.
In 1981, I'm like, I wish I had $500 for a video printer. This would rule. Again, don't do this at home.
No.
You kids have it so easy these days.
But we do it here, so you don't have to.
Like we were saying, though, this is a film that, you know, was overlooked by a lot of people. I mean, there's how many people our age probably don't even know what it is.
Right. And so, anyway, looking back at the film career of Floyd Mutrix, who I know he's done a little bit of musical theater production, and there's some lawsuits with that, but we won't talk about that. But, like, in 1971 was his film debut, which he wrote and directed, called Dusty and Sweets McGee, which is on the Warner Archives. I believe it's two lovers who grow into drug addiction. 1975, and I only got this because I knew he was involved with it, but it was a film called Aloha, Bobby, and Rose with Paul LaMatte and Diane Hull.
Yeah.
And this was so, of course, Paul LaMatt was in American Graffiti. And because of the success of American Graffiti, almost everybody in that film got a starring vehicle. And this was his. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of, if you, and Tim McIntyre, who we'll get to in a little bit, it was kind of a modern day Bonnie and Clyde, if Bonnie and Clyde were on the Sunset Strip in 1974. With also great music, don't know where they got the rights to it. I always remember a great shot of the Sunset Strip with Junior Walker and the All-Stars playing in that. Tim McIntyre is in this film. He would play Alan Freed in his film American Hot Wax, which I remember seeing in the theaters with my parents. That came out in 78. And, of course, Freed, the famous rock and roll DJ. And at that time, they were able to get Chuck Berry, Jerry Lee Lewis, and was it Little Richard, I believe?
I think
who,
so. Yeah.
Who play themselves at the first rock and roll concert. Then, of course, the Hollywood Nights in 1980, and then a film with Rick Schroeder. Yeah, he was Rick then. In 1994, called "There Goes My Baby." He would also have story or screenplay credits for "Freebie and the Bean," James Caan and Alan Arkin, "American Me," the film starring and directed by Edward James Olmos. Blood In, Blood Out, which was the Taylor Hackford film. I believe Benjamin Bratt was in that. 3-hour film about living in the Chicano section of Los Angeles. And then he had a story credit for Mulholland Falls, the Hat Squad film with Nick Nolte back in 1996. So
another really underrated film.
Really?
If you enjoy, you know, guys wearing hats.
Guys wearing hats and kicking butt and taking names. So anyway, fascinating. And Floyd Muttrix is still around. He has a website. You can go check it out. Yeah, you can tell him, you know, we're talking about his work here at NPR.
It lives.
It does live. So we were talking earlier about where does the R-rated slob comedy begin? And some people would say Animal House, but I was going through, and I'm sure there's a myriad of smaller titles that I'm forgetting, so I can't wait for your emails. But I think the first one for me is 1974 and Blazing Saddles.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which you were telling a story earlier of showing it to young folks and didn't quite have the same reaction as we did.
Well, yeah. I mean, I was working with a bunch of 20-year-olds, and I was 30-some at the time, and we were talking about movies that really made us laugh, and to this day, Blazing Saddles can make me laugh out loud and blow, you know, whatever I'm drinking right through my nose. But they'd never seen it, and so I invited them over to the house and showed it to them, and they were absolutely appalled, particularly at the number of times white men say the N-word.
Right.
And back in the 70s, it was even pushing the envelope back in the 70s.
Correct.
But, you know, When you have Richard Pryor as one of the writers, it's going to happen.
And also the fact that Pryor didn't do all the quote unquote black jokes.
Right.
You know, Mel Brooks wrote a lot of those.
But it ruined the entire movie for them.
Wow.
So, you know, they didn't even make it to the campfire scene before they were just totally disengaged.
Wow, we're old.
Yeah.
We're old and a different generation.
That's too bad. I mean, to me, that they don't get Mel Brooks. Then they need to maybe see some of his other films.
Young Frankenstein, silent movie.
Yeah. Right.
Boy, The Producers,
Spaceballs.
There you go. Okay, so also in 1974, The Longest Yard.
Nice.
Thank you, Bert. And The Groove Tube.
Oh yeah.
That of course there's a couple of those films that come later in the decade of their. Basically, before SNL, there was adult sketch comedy.
Kentucky Fried Movie?
Yes, that's one of
Tunnel
those.
Tunnel Vision
actually,
was another one.
Tunnel Vision. Can I do it till I need glasses?
Yeah.
Which had Robin Williams. Really cheap, quickly made film. But yeah, 1977, Kentucky Fried Movie. 1978, of course, you have Animal House, and that really blew it up. That also in 1978, Up in Smoke.
Nice. Yep.
Cool.
People would probably say that the apex of the R-rated slob comedy could be 1980 because in 1 year, ladies and gentlemen, you have Caddyshack, The Hollywood Nights,
yep.
Airplane,
mm-hmm.
History of the World Part 1, Used Cars, and Mad Magazine's Up the Academy.
What about the other Richard Pryor, Gene Wilder, they get locked
stir
in
crazy.
Stir
no,
crazy.
I don't think that's a slob comedy. I think because one of the things that, and I'm almost leery to put Airplane on this list and to a certain degree, Blazing. I think we're thinking of, I think, you know, the horny guys chasing after girls.
Right on.
It has
yeah.
to be a major or at least a minor part of that. Sorry, folks, it's what it is.
Slight degree of immaturity to it.
Slight, yep. yeah, slight degree of that. And those were all in 1 year.
Right.
1981, you had Stripes. And in 1982, in 1 year, Porky's. And then my friend Erin, she put in two guesses as we were. She had asked me what we were going to be talking about on social media. One of her guesses was used cars.
Right.
Love used cars.
Classic, yeah.
yep. Thank you, Kurt Russell. But she also asked if we were going to talk about Night Shift.
I love Night Shift.
Not a
complete.
Maybe no teenagers, but although the Clint Howard character maybe, but
yes.
But yeah, these were films. I think these are all a part of our canon. Well, us three. I don't know about you guys, but
Night Shift was Billy Blazejowski. that was Michael Keaton's kind of first
right out
big,
the gate.
Right.
I mean, and, you know, yeah, Henry
his
Winkler.
Character was so funny. I remember.
Yeah, that was supposed to be the movie to make a movie star out of Henry Winkler,
and it did.
It
not really
kind of made a movie star out of Michael Keaton.
Yeah, it did, and salute to Shelley Long.
Yeah.
But yeah, because he had already had a couple of films after because he was in Heroes and the One and Only
Heroes.
The Lords
was
of Flatbush
sad, though, wasn't it?
Well, Lords of Flatbush was before Happy Days. That's 74.
Okay.
But these were at the during his reign on Happy Days. Mm-hmm. Where so he had three attempts at being a movie star during the series, and they even sadly Night Shift didn't do that well.
No.
Although again, it was on cable constantly.
Right, I love it. Yeah,
yeah, it's yeah. This and that we can quote Michael Keaton quite a bit. Not on this show, of course.
I just love the plot in that movie. You know, let's take a funeral home, you know, graveyard shift, so to speak. You know, and open up a side business on top of it.
And it was also, you know, the young upstart who had just gotten out of the Roger Corman School of Filmmaking and got to do a major picture for Warner Brothers. Way to go, Ron.
Yeah.
So, all right.
Whatever became of him?
I think he did a Moby Dick film last year.
Oh, cool.
So, we got a few more minutes before we wrap up on this very special Film Sociology Hollywood Nights. And I'm already going to date the show already because we have a moment for dead people we like because we never have time for dead people we don't like. And I hope I'm saying this right. And I'm sorry if I say it wrong. Pardon my anyway. Actor Bert Kwok, Kwouk.
Mm-hmm.
Who was born in England, died on May 24th at the age of 85. Gentlemen, he did a lot of TV. He did quite a few movies. But if anything else, you will always remember him as Cato.
Oh, yeah.
The Pink Panther. Yeah.
Spectre Clouseau.
Right. So, and you know, if there's time at the end, maybe, you know, I'm not the first one to say, of course, at his funeral, he will jump out of the casket and attack Clouseau.
With a stick and beat you down.
Again, he is. I should say this because we do this quite often. You've witnessed Mike on the show. The man had a full career. He had a full working career, and he's going to be best known for attacking Peter Sellers.
Yep.
Right.
And it's funny as hell.
Playing a part with very few lines.
No. You know? And the great moment of they're fighting, and no matter what happens, if the phone rings, he answers it.
Yes.
That's a good
he
servant.
He stays loyal. Yes.
And yes, college students. Yes, he shouldn't. Clouseau shouldn't have called him his little yellow friend.
Yeah.
I got it. But the fight scenes are funny as hell.
Yeah.
Yes.
So.
Especially the slow motion.
And you know what? That might have been, for a bunch of us, our introduction to the concept of the joke in slow motion.
Yes.
So I'm looking back to see what else he had done before, especially if you're a TV or a bit player, you know, what other things. That's not a reflection of your career, sir.
No.
Films like Passport to China, The Sinister Man from the 1960s, of course, Shot in the Dark. He played Mr. Ling in Goldfinger.
Mm-hmm.
Was in three different episodes in the early 60s of The Avengers. Of course, he was in The Brides of Fu Manchu with everyone's favorite Asian actor, Christopher Lee. was uncredited in Casino Royale. Was Spectre number 3 in You Only Live Twice. Played Chairman Peng in The Shoes of the Fisherman. Was in The Chairman, Deep End. Of course, all the Pink Panther films. Was the Doctor in Rollerball, the original Rollerball, the
James
only
Conn,
one
yes.
that matters. Yeah,
right.
That remake is terrible.
That was another one I saw on HBO.
Constantly.
Yes.
Great stuff. The last remake of Bogest. Played Lin Futu in 1982 in Doctor Who. films like Plenty. He played Mr. Chen in Empire of the Sun, was in Kiss of the Dragon, Carry On Columbus. And one of the last things he did was, I think in 2010, he was in several episodes of Last of the Summer Wine for you PBS people out there.
Oh, you Telly Club members.
There you go. So, Bert, thank you. You made us laugh. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
So, gentlemen, we just got a couple minutes. Closing thoughts on The Hollywood Nights, Chris.
Well, I'm probably going to go home and watch it again today.
So
once I start talking about it, I need to go back and feed my imagination.
Have you forced this film on your family yet?
They wouldn't get it. I mean, my wife and my two daughters would not. They would probably walk out of the room and say, well, "This is stupid," or something. You know, but
and they'd be right. But
that's
still
that's why it's funny. Yeah.
That's why it's funny. If you haven't seen the movie, see if you can, you know, rent a copy or stream it, or you know, check Amazon. You can get it at a very reasonable price.
Yes.
And just let it flow over you. Don't try to think too much about it. Just enjoy the little
We're still quoting it 35 years later.
You're making it sound like a Kubrick film. It's like 2001. But yeah, you're right.
But it does have Robert Wool. It does have Fran Drescher, Tony Danza, Michelle Pfeiffer, Stuart Pankin. I mean, there are some big names.
You know what? I still think it's – and I'm sure Robert Wool would tell me to go bleep myself, but I think it's his best work. And this is the man that created Arliss and was in Batman. Yeah. So.
I agree, though. His character of Nubom Turk was
It was supposed to be
not
the
ordinary guy.
It was supposed to be the Bluto of the group, and, well, I guess it was. But
he had a very – it seemed like a very high IQ. This is a very smart guy, not just a prankster. But
except when he messes with his brother's El Camino.
That's true. Oh, the pie wagon. Oh.
And yeah, so anyway, gentlemen, we have some words to live by.
Lawrence of Arabia, he's an English guy. He came to fight the Turkish.
Okay, Clark, right there. That's what I'm talking about. Well, Lawrence of Arabia doesn't have any lyrics to it. Doesn't have any words.
What do you mean doesn't have lyrics?
It's music. It's music.
Hey, I've seen the movie four times.
And there were no words to it.
What are you
there are no words to that. Did you hear what I was singing earlier?
Somewhere I know that somebody, I think, wrote lyrics to this song.
Go see this great movie. You deserve it, whether you know it or not. Chris, Mike, thanks for hanging out.
Thank you, Matt. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Matt.
You've been listening to a very special film sociology, The More You Know. So go find this. I own a copy of it. You're on your own. I'm happy to own this. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
Inspector Clouseau's residence.
The phone is ringing.
From 2016, a breakdown of the film The Hollywood Nights as a salute to Mike Perry, who is retiring, but he's always got a place here at Film Sociology. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. We'll get to the grab a pencil portion of the show in a bit, but I want to go back to some stuff I've been watching, special features, bonus discs, that sort of thing. In the Arrow Video release of Django, the Ultra 4K release, there is a second film, a second disc with all sorts of goodies. It's the 1966 Western Texas Adios, also starring Franco Nero, sometimes called Django 2, even though it's not. This is the film he did after Django. He plays a sheriff with a hot-headed younger brother who go across the border to Mexico to go after the man who killed their father. Apparently, this was shot near – this is an Italian and Spanish production, and this was shot near where The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly was also being filmed, the Spanish province of Almeria. And apparently, Nero and Clint Eastwood got to hang out together, so that's fun. This film, except for one really good plot point near the end of the film involving the connection between the man who killed their father and the two boys, the two grown men. Other than that, this feels like the second half of a double feature. So it's kind of appropriate that this is the second film on this collection from Arrow Video. It's also directed by Fernando Baldi, who would later go on, before this, did David and Goliath, The Tartars with Orson Welles and Victor Mature, Duel of Champions with Alan Ladd, and he would also do another Django ripoff called Django Prepare a Coffin with Terrence Hill in 1968. But then he got into more interesting fare, not necessarily better, just interesting, like Blind Man with Tony Anthony and Ringo Starr, which we've talked on this, which we've discussed on this show with Dan Epstein. Get Mean, he works with Tony Anthony again, and then works with Tony Anthony in 1981 with Coming At You, the 3D Western, which I remember. And then with Anthony once again in 1983's Treasure of the Four Crowns. So, you know, he was a kind of a bandwagon director, as you hear, in 1960, doing the Sword and Sandal gladiator movies, getting into Westerns, and then by 1983, the post Raiders of the Lost Ark stuff from Fernando Baldi. So, yeah, Texas Adios is a part of the Arrow Video collection of Django, the Ultra 4K release. So, and I'll be still going through some of the stuff. I like that. Also from Arrow Video, as I mentioned, the Bill Rabain collection, starting to go through after going over Monster of Go-Go, which is a tough act to follow. We get 1974's Invasion from Inner Earth. The Canadian wilderness this is where the film is set, even though it's Tomahawk, Wisconsin. You have some folks living in the wilderness as there is an epidemic happening in quote unquote civilization. Some very frantic editing at the beginning of people running from an invasion, and there's a pilot and guess that he takes from the wilderness back into civilization. They find out that things are not as they seem, because it's an epidemic of UFO proportions. And this is a color film, so seeing the kind of Ed Wood level UFO moments, albeit brief, in color are really jarring. This is kind of, as I was writing with the UFO invasion, it's 1954 material, but it's shot in 1974. We have a really odd ending on who is left and who isn't. This is one of and Bill does a couple of these films very similar. Monster of Go-Go is like this to a certain degree. A lot of talk, not a lot of action, and could even be shorter than it already is. The lot of talk, not a lot of action also plagues 1978's The Alpha Incident, shot in Gleason, Wisconsin. And even though it has Ralph Meeker in it, an alien organism has accidentally been released in small-town USA. And while we get, and eventually we get to the highlight is four people, three men and a woman, quarantined in a train depot. It gets into bad Edward Albee territory with this. Oh, and by the way, as a weird oddity, there's a character known as the official, the kind of government official. One of the four folks stuck in the train depot is a government agent who trying to help out with how things are going with the organism. But his boss is a guy named the official, played by Ray Zamanda, better known as the Menards guy. Yeah, you can look that up. But yeah, we have three men and one woman who are trying to stay awake because we're told if we fall asleep, we die. So there's more talking, and it gets really unpleasant fast, especially with the lone woman involved. There's dancing and resisting and some chicanery going on, and the death of Ralph Meeker's character, not really a spoiler alert, is expensive and still looks bad and cheap, and a really down ending. Really down ending when it comes to, and it's interesting because we've been, you know, it's been the last year and a half, maybe not the greatest film to watch, although it's a bleak ending. So yeah, another one of a lot of talk and not a whole lot of action. And when we do get some action, oh boy. So, yeah, that's the Alpha Incident from 1978. A step up is 1983's The Demon of Ludlow, set in a New England town, actually Gleason, Wisconsin. It is a town's 200th anniversary, a very small town, a town with a dark past. And they bring in a harmonium, which was originally owned by the origin of the Ludlow family, the family in which the town is named after. It's not really a harmonium. It's an upright piano and sounds like a harmonium. And that's one of the more entertaining aspects of this. And a church that looks like a living room. And as we find out as time goes on, everybody has a past and everybody has some past sins to deal with. And at times, this was probably inspired by the film The Fog when it comes to small New England town and crazy stuff happening. We got some voiceover reporting or some voiceover work from a reporter who used to grow up in the small town and left at a very young age. It's very odd. We do get the blood floating from the leaking from the piano, and we get floating objects, which you don't see the strings. I'll give it that. Some minor camera trickery as far as somebody disappearing from a chair. You got some bizarre flashbacks, and they don't really change the scenery. It's just actors in costumes. Or as I've written on other Bill Rubain notes, actors or friends. And we have a demon bursting from a ceiling with a noose. There's an exploding piano climax. This one is a little more fun to watch than the just a lot of talk and no action. There's more action and not as much talk in The Demons of Ludlow from the Bill Rubain collection from Arrow Video. So I'll be continuing on with these films hopefully in the next couple of weeks. And finally, I finally got to season 5 of Laugh-In. 1971, Gary Owens has a mustache now. And after 4 years of jokes at her expense, Raquel Welch finally makes an appearance and has a good time. It's fun watching her in this. And for 1971, what I've been doing with this is with the Laugh-In series, for those who have not heard earlier episodes, Time Life Home Video sent me the complete series of Laugh-In, 6 seasons. So thank you, Time Life. And what I've been doing is revisiting the show. A lot of episodes I've not seen. I've only seen pieces. It's a kind of a greatest hits aspect. And there's a lot of movie stars that became guest stars or just made cameos. And if it was not 1971, they would be promoting anything that they were involved in. And there's some mentions of some films that the actors or TV shows that the special guests are working on. But I thought, what would it be like if they were plugging whatever they were working on the year they appeared? So, for instance, Raquel Welch, 1971, she had already appeared in Myra Breckinridge, and then that same year was in Hanny Calder, the Western, as well as The Beloved, a.k.a. Sin. You have the Ruth Buzzi character of Gladys makes a joke at the expense of the sensuous woman. Jill St. John has a cameo. That's the year she was the Bond girl in Diamonds Are Forever. There was one episode that had athletes on it like Wilt Chamberlain and Vida Blue. Now, it's not until 2 years later, but it's also a chance for me to remind folks that Vida Blue played the character of Sam Green in the 1973 Jim Brown action-packed thing called Black Gun with he and Martin Landau. Rita Hayworth makes an appearance. She was doing The Road to Selena at that time. There's a joke at the expense of George C. Scott winning Best Actor. Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice joke because it's 1971. Ruth Buzzi plays a Hollywood gossip columnist and makes a joke that there's going to be a biopic about Charlton Heston and it'll be played by God. Jacqueline Suzanne shows up. Her novel, The Love Machine, was made into a film that year. Another joke about Marlon Brando as the Godfather. Dean Jones shows up. Now, he had a TV show called The Chicago Teddy Bears, which didn't last long, but that same year he was in Disney's The Million Dollar Duck. Frank Gorshin shows up. So, yeah, I'll tell you what films the actors he impersonated appeared on. Richard Burton in 1971. Oof, man, this is rough stuff. Villain, Under Milk Wood, and Raid on Rommel. When Villain's the best of those threes, that's not saying a whole lot. And then Kirk Douglas, he impersonated Kirk Douglas. There was A Gunfight, Catch Me a Spy, and The Light at the Edge of the World. Gary Owens makes a joke about Willard. There's one episode that has Tarzan and his wife, Mrs. Tarzan. Chad Everett, who was on the series Medical Center, but he also did a film called The Fire Chasers. Liza Minnelli makes an appearance. She had already done Sterile Cuckoo, as well as Tell Me That You Love Me, Junie Moon. And this is before Cabaret. James Coco, who was billed as being currently on Broadway in The Last of the Red Hot Lovers. He was also in the film Such Good Friends and A New Leaf in 1971. Vincent Price makes an appearance. This is the year of the Abominable Dr. Fibes, and that's the really good streak of films that Price had in the early 70s. Gary Owens makes a joke about Dr. Doolittle losing his license after being in a film that lost so much money. Vincent Price makes a joke about The Fly, as well as Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. It's a pot joke on TV in 1971. And another joke at Jack Palance's expense. And Janet Leigh makes a cameo, and she tells one of the actors that she cannot, because of Psycho, she cannot shower when Anthony Perkins is in the same room. There's a whole bit about the mod world of movie making. Frank Gorshin impersonates Burt Lancaster, and this is while 1971 Lancaster does two of the three westerns in a row that I've always found fascinating. Lawman, Valdez Is Coming, based on the novel by film sociology guest Elmore Leonard, and then in 1972 would appear in Robert Aldrich's Olzano's Raid. Fascinating trio there. Ruth also plays Laverne Blossom, which is a character based on Gloria Swanson. Another Charlton Heston joke. There's a Laurel and Hardy bit. There's a bit about 12 O'Clock High. Richard Crenna shows up. You forget Richard Crenna can sing and dance and do funny voices. Doctor's Wives, Cat Low, the Western, if you want to see Yul Brynner, Richard Crenna, and a kind of naked Leonard Nimoy, you're welcome, and the film Red Sky at Morning. I mentioned Janet Leigh. She doesn't have a film in 1971, but the next year she does Night of the Lepus, because I have to mention that. Lee Grant shows up. She, of course, was in the film version of Plaza Suite with Walter Matthau. And for their 100th show, besides having a reunion of some of their heavy hitters, John Wayne appears again. 1971, he did Big Jake. So there you go. That's season 5. I'm still working on season 5 and eventually season 6. Of laughing because it's fun. All right, let's grab a pencil. Well, actually, let's see what's happening at the drive-ins, and then we'll grab a pencil. Over at the Tibbs drive-in, we have on screen one, you have A Quiet Place Part 2 and Top Gun. Sure. Screen two, Cruella and Raya and the Last Dragon, two Disney films. Screen three, The Conjuring, The Devil Made Me Do It. Don't tell Flip Wilson you use that. As well as Godzilla vs. Kong. And then screen four, Spirit Untamed and the first Shrek. That's at the Tibbs Drive-In. Over at the Skyline Drive-In, you have Quiet Place Part 2 and Top Gun. Okay, and just a reminder, Wednesday, June 23rd at the Skyline Drive-In, they are showing The Killing of a Chinese Bookie and Cutting Class, and I'm trying to see if I can make it over there. Tuesday, June 8th at IU Cinema, it is the monthly movie roundup virtual edition at 7 o'clock. It says, join us for a virtual edition of the monthly movie roundup, a regular series featured on IU Cinema's blog, A Place for Film. And at the Historic Art Craft Theater tomorrow, Saturday, at 2 and 7:30 p.m., A Star is Born. And then Tuesday, June 8th at 10 a.m. is Hook. Friday and Saturday, June 11th and 12th at 2 and 7:30 p.m., American Graffiti. At the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin. All right, friends, you're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Grab a pencil. Here we go. We start with Vicky, who writes Arsenic and Old Lace and The Best Years of Our Lives. All right, a couple old goodies there. George writes Hymns. Craig writes Zeffirelli's The Taming of the Shrew. Good one there, Craig. Britt writes Wonder Woman 1984, Mitchells vs. Machine, Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, Wrath of the Titans, Night of the Hunter, A Child is Waiting, Flintstones Viva Rock Vegas, Independence Day, the 2020 film version of The Witches, Scoob, Bolt, Wreck-It Ralph, Cinderella's Story, Once Upon a Song, and Who is Charlie? So, Britt, you must be done with Game of Thrones. So there you go. Lou writes, Lou Harry, the assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford, In the Heights, Knight of Cups, Oslo, and Plan B. Joe writes, the 2017 film Rommel, Bloodwork, Master and Commander, and The Vikings. Tiffany writes, Life of Brian, Midnight Special, Most Wanted, and The Big Lebowski. Nancy writes, Minari. Taylor writes, Zack Snyder's Justice League, Attack of the 50-Foot Woman, Monuments Men, and Horatio Hornblower. Nancy writes, all rewatched except for Hacks. Get Him to the Greek, Hamilton, Hot Tub Time Machine, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which she says may be my favorite Tarantino film. Nothing wrong with that, dear. Hacks, not a movie but a great show, and then started Mayor of Easttown. Thank you, Nancy. Sean writes A Quiet Place Part 2. Ron writes The Late Show. Gretchen writes The Woman in the Window. Devin writes The Many Adventures of Winnie the Pooh, Cruella, Pooh's Grand Adventure, The Search for Christopher Robin. Don Hipschweiler, our very own Don Hipschweiler, writes Nomadland. Kevin writes An Inspector Calls. Phil writes the Watch the Long Riders last night, having visited Northfield, Minnesota yesterday afternoon. Thank you, Phil. Eric writes Howl, William Wyler's Memphis Belle, A Story of Flying Fortress, Dark of the Sun, Run Silent, Run Deep, The Enemy Below, The Boston Strangler, made fun of on Laughing, The Spirit of Beehive, and Ealing Studios' 1958 epic Dunkirk. Doug writes 1962 films, The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner, Divorce Italian Style, War Hunt, Merrill's Marauders, A Taste of Honey, Knife in the Water, and Billy Budd. And from 1968, Funny Girl. Andra writes The Dry. Roxanne writes Cruella. I love, love, loved it. Very good, Roxanne. And congratulations on your work anniversary. Greg writes, we saw A Quiet Place Part 2 in an actual theater. Loved it. Very scary. The kids in the film are great. Thank you, Greg. Linda writes, Cruella, fun 60s soundtrack. And some 70s stuff there, too. Dustin writes, Network, Risky Business, When Harry Met Sally, Billy Elliot, Angels in America, Moneyball, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, Friends the Reunion, and Cruella. Joni writes Love in a Cold Climate and Talladega Nights. Dan writes Dan Epstein, who I mentioned earlier, the original version of The Taking of the Pelham 1-2-3, and adds damn fine soundtrack and theme. Julia writes Confessions of a Teenage Drama Queen, Back to the Future, The Dark Horse from 1946 with the note, My Great Aunt was an extra in it. Cool. Moonraker, For Your Eyes Only, and 1949's Battleground. Mike White writes Bruce Lee movies for me. Very good. Kim writes High on the Hog, How African-American Cuisine Transformed America. Powerful, beautiful, sad at times, uplifting, such a critical story to share. Thank you, Kim. Roger writes, haven't seen a film in a few weeks, but Mayor of Easttown on HBO is terrific. I've seen four episodes now, three to go, good stuff. Missy writes, still working on Boston Legal. Seems like I watched something last week, but can't recall. Oh, well. Thanks, Missy. Rachel writes, Sherlock Holmes, The Woman in Green, My Man Godfrey, and Lady Godiva of the Coventry. Jed writes, me and the wife went and saw Cruella last night for our anniversary. It was fantastic. Highly recommended. Michelle writes, Master and Commander, A Quiet Place Part 2. It was awesome. David writes, Rosewood, Clockers, Mobetta Blues, and Unpregnant. Andy writes, Get Shorty, bonafide classic heist comedy, classic. Every scene is funny. Every joke still lands. A top five Travolta performance, and John Medeski jamming on all of the score music. What's not to love? I watched it to make sure and confirmed it's a family R movie I can show the kids. Like My Cousin Vinny, light breezy comedy, whose only offenses are a few too many F-words. Yeah, I try not to keep count, Andy. But any others that come to mind with that, you could do. Oh, now I'm getting show suggestions. Andy says, any others that come to mind like that, you can do a show on this category. Parents would love it. I'll have to work. I'll think about that, Andy. Actually, that's the family R is interesting because, words don't bother me either. And so that is we're a little more loose here at the Soce household. But she's 19 now. So anyway, I'll think about that. I'll think about that. Thank you, Andy. Charity writes The Woman in the Window. Michael writes Kiss of Death, Two Towers, and Moonraker. Molly writes Colossal, Misbehavior, Cruella, Raya and the Last Dragon, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and Hairspray. Tony writes Contempt and the Asphalt Jungle. Enjoy those photos you got, Tony. Lila writes Cruella. Both Emmas were amazing, as well as Sound of Metal. Austin writes Smiles of a Summer Night, Wild Strawberries, and the Umbrellas of Cherbourg. And this is Austin Glidden. Look for his Medium Cool podcast. You might hear a certain film sociology person on it. Carrie writes Without Remorse, Captain America, The Winter Soldier, again for the millionth time. Nobody's judging here. Eden writes The Cowboys with John Wayne. Elbio writes Mephisto and La Croix de Brume. Pardon my French. Pardon just me being American. JJ writes Eddie and the Cruisers 2, Eddie Lives. If the movie didn't predate my own career, I swear they stole some of my characters, just like Jeff Beck and Nigel Tufnel. When he gets off on the band, he sounds like me. He ain't wrong either, busting their chops for overplaying, not being in the pocket, etc. Best line in the movie is at the end of this early scene. He provides a clip, so I'm not going to play that. But thank you, J.J. Vickers. Yes, musician extraordinaire. Ronnie writes Glory, Fire in the Sky, and The Client. Gail writes Ingrid Goes West with Aubrey Plaza and Elizabeth Olsen. A bit odd and intense, but a very cool film on how we can, quote-unquote, connect over digital media. I did like that one, Gail, as well. Lisa writes The Meyerowitz Stories and Halston. Eric writes The Birdcage. Dave writes The Buena Vista Social Club. Scott writes Motherless Brooklyn. Leo writes, continuing my Ghibli streak with Princess Mononoke, powerfully spiritual film, far and away my favorite Ghibli. Thank you, Leo. Robert Muggy writes, to each his own, Darling, How Could You, Hands Across the Table, Midnight, Dance Girl Dance, Nothing Sacred, and My Man Godfrey. Christopher Lloyd writes, Marathon, Donovan's Wreath, Undine, It Happened Tomorrow, and Spirit Untamed. Jennifer writes North by Northwest, Indiscreet, and Notorious. Frank writes, I just rewatched the original Death Race 2000. Very silly. David writes The New Mutants and follows it with Meh, and A Quiet Place Part 2. James writes Cicada and A Quiet Place Part 2. Barry writes, we just watched The Quietly Astonishing Nomadland on DVD. Courageous, understated, unbowed. All I can say is no wonder it garnered all the acclaim and awards. Barry, I am with you on that. That was my top film of last year. Tom writes, iRobot. Moveen writes, thanks to IU Cinema, watch Princess Tam Tam and Zuzu with Josephine Baker. She is awesome and rarely recognized for her talent and civic and social contributions. Daniel writes, Tammy, Tell Me True, Shampoo, Midnight, The Father, Rush Hour, Risky Business, Madea Witness Protection, Casablanca, What Have I Done to Deserve This, Lady in White, and How to Steal a Million. Martin writes, Punching Henry, semi-autobiographical, bittersweet, dark comedy, fictionalizing comedian Henry Phillips' gigs. And finally, Alex writes, Quiet Place Part 2. Did I love it because I was back in the theater for the first time, or was it good? Who cares? I did indeed love it. Thank you, Alex. Thank you for sharing, everybody. So there you go. And I don't know, maybe soon I will get into a theater and see something in the theater. We'll see. But I want to, again, thank everybody for contributing on social media. Let us know what titles you've been watching. It's been great when there's been cross-pollination. And we'll try again next week. So, friends, some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there. Now, before we take off, I want to raise a glass to a few people we like, because we don't have time for dead people we don't like. Of course, actor Gavin McLeod passed away, I believe, at the age of 90. And yes, he has two huge TV credits. But I went back to his IMDb with credits going back to 1957 when it comes to television as well as movies, playing a police lieutenant in I Want to Live, including that, Porkchop Hill, Operation Petticoat, 12 Hours to Kill, High Time, War Hunt, yes, McHale's Navy, and McHale's Navy Joins the Air Force, Death Watch, The Sword of Ali Baba, The Sand Pebbles, A Man Called Gannon, The Party, The Thousand Plane Raid, The Comic, and of course Moriarty and Kelly's Heroes. And then a lot of television after that. So salute to Gavin. Stunt coordinator turned director Buddy Van Horn also passed away on May 11th at the age of 92. Directed three Clint Eastwood films, Any Which Way You Can, The Deadpool, and Pink Cadillac. And if you look through, did a slew of credited and uncredited stunt work. Also had got to be an actor and a stuntman in films like Spartacus, The Beguiled, Paint Your Wagon, High Plains Drifter, Bite the Bullet, Pale Rider, and Shakedown, among others, and then a slew of credits in the stunt world. So salute to you, gentlemen. And we're going to end this week's Film Sociology, extra long, extra special Film Sociology, with music from B.J. Thomas. Yes, that song, one of the biggest screeching halts in cinema history, and it, for many people, becomes their favorite part of the film. And it's also a song that got that, also helped get that movie a lot of play and a lot of butts in seats. But we ask from Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, B.J. Thomas, Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head. And we'll try this again next week, friends. Hope you're staying safe. Hope you're staying healthy. Hope you're staying sane. Hope you're being good to one another. Hope you're getting your shots. And hope you're watching some good films that are new, or at least new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
Raindrops are falling on my head, and just like the guy whose feet are too big for his bed, nothing seems to fit. Those raindrops are falling on my head, they keep falling. So I just did need some talking to the sun, and I said I didn't like the way he got things done. Sleeping on the job, those raindrops are falling on my head, they keep falling. But there's one thing I know, the blues they send to meet me won't defeat me. It won't be.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
Okay. We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!